Last week, we've jumped into the series, and this Sunday and next Sunday are going to be kind of the last 2 weeks. And you'll see the title of this series that we've been on, Breaking the Chains of Family Baggage. And I will have more books. We sold out some of the resources for that, and we're going to order some more in. We'll have them hopefully here by next week, next Sunday. But last Sunday, we looked at the idea of forgiveness. And forgiveness really is a weighty ideal, and it's a process, and we looked at that. But one of the illustrations I used was Corey Ten Boom, and Corey was in a prison at a death camp in Germany, and her sister died at that camp, and it was actually at one of the hands of a guard that she ran into later. At a speaking event, she ended up coming across with this guy, and she had to figure out how to forgive this man who contributed to the death of her sister and countless other people. Now, Deanna and I have gone to Poland a number of times, and one of those trips, and one of those missions trips, we went to Auschwitz, and I just got a couple pictures on there, that death camp in Poland. And this first picture here is a group of women where their heads have been shaved in that camp. Now, I don't know if you realize this, but what they would do is they would take the hair of all the prisoners and they would put it all together and put that next slide up here. This is actually what we saw. This is a reenactment. There's a spot in one of the buildings where they would put all the hair of the individuals that they would shave off. The trip was a deeply hard for just to walk through that camp and to see it. You see the depravity of people, and you kind of go, how in the world can you get to that point? But in this hair, they would use it actually to make work clothes and to line the boots of some of the soldiers, for the German soldiers. Mankind. People can hurt people. Sobering in that sense. But in Germany, as they came out of that World War II, there are a couple things that they tried to do and say and teach even the kids that experienced the war. And one of the phrases that they would say to the German students is they would admit to the students that, you know what, we were responsible for the war. And we were now responsible for freedom, was a statement that would be said sometimes. And in that teaching the kids, they were told this, don't ever forget the horrors of war and what went on. Never forget. Never forget is a path that a lot of people take when it comes even though to family baggage. And stuff that's happened in the past in our lives. The idea of never forgetting. Never, don't let go, don't forget. Actually, the call sometimes is to remember. Matter of fact, even you think of 9/11, there's days now that are set aside not to forget, but to remember. Pearl Harbor Day, another one. The call to remember those events that took past in the past. And in one sense, it's never forget, but never again as well. How do you apply that idea to our series? Let me put up part of just a portion of the verse of the theme passage for us today. I just want to read that again. It says this from Exodus 34. The sins of the parents are laid upon their children and grandchildren. The entire family is affected, even children in the third and the fourth generations. See, the Bible makes it clear that sin has this ripple effect, not only to us individually, but to the people that come beyond us, our children and their children and their children. But there's another biblical principle that we can't hide from in that process. Look at Galatians 6 again. We've had this up on the screen before, but it says this, don't be misled. No one makes a fool of God. What a person plants, he will harvest. The person who plants selfishness, ignoring the needs of others, ignoring God, harvests a crop of weeds. All he'll have to show for his life is weeds. But the one who plants in response to God, letting God's Spirit do the work in him, harvests a crop of real life, eternal life. What we plant, we sow. We cannot hide from that principle. Sin and dysfunction and sometimes our parenting impacts our children and their children and their children. But the idea that these words that says never forget, never again, I think typify at times where we want to head in our understandings of our family. We don't want to forget what happened to us, the way we were raised. We don't want to forget that love was missing in our families. It isn't easy to forget. So we learn to live by maybe the phrase, never again. Now, if you've done any examination, even into your own family, don't we think like this as a parent? I'm not going to be that kind of husband and wife that I observed. I'm not going to be that kind of parent. I'm not going to raise my children that way. I'm not going to do to them what was done to me. I will be a different mother. I'm going to be a different father. I'm going to be a father that I never had. See, because of those kind of thoughts that go through our minds, forgetting doesn't come easy. Last week, the process of moving forward is forgiveness. If you missed it, you can listen to that online and get caught up. But today, what does it mean to even go beyond forgiveness? See, today, though, here's where we got to go. I want to jump back into a biblical story. And we actually began the introduction to the series with this story. If you've got your Bibles, you can turn to Genesis 37. But we need to take another look at this family, maybe one of the most dysfunctional families in all of the Bible. And it clearly shows how the sin went from generation to generation to generation. And it started with Abraham. I don't know if we realize that. If you remember the story, Abraham needed to wait for a son that God had promised. But he wasn't patient. And remember what he did is he took a slave girl and he bore Ishmael. And the resulting amnesty actually haunts those generations and those lines of generation today. But finally, to Abraham, born to Sarah, was a son named Isaac. Now, I'm not going to dig into the reading of it, but I understand that Isaac left a legacy as well. You know, Isaac actually, Abraham's son, he wasn't that great of a husband nor a father. He struggled to get along with his wife, Rebecca. And one of the struggles, I pointed this out at the beginning of the series, was the issue of favoritism. Rebecca favored Jacob, which actually led to more deceit. Isaac favored Esau. And understand the environment as that they grew up, all of a sudden, you understand, things begin to flow into the next generation, flowing into Jacob's future family. And Jacob began to adopt many of the practices that he learned from his family dynamics all the way back to Abraham. Now, Jacob, if you remember the story, Jacob had 12 sons, and they became the head of the tribes of Israel, carrying the names of the tribes. Remember the tribe of Reuben, the tribe of Benjamin, the tribe of Dan, and so on and so on. But the dysfunction of this family was taking place, understand, even before a single child was born. Jacob, I think you could describe it as a bizarre marriage. Jacob comes across a woman of his dreams, or as he sees this woman, he goes, I'm going to marry that woman, and her name was Rachel. If you know the story, he goes to Rachel's father to ask Rachel to be his wife, and that was the tradition. He had to go to dad to ask for the daughter, and Rachel's father told him, I want you to work for me for 7 years, and then you can have his daughter as his wife. So Jacob worked for 7 years. As I thought of that, I go, that would have been kind of nice, wouldn't it? Dad's out there if you have a daughter. 7 years of mowing lawn? Just think of all the things we could get done around our house if we could do that, okay? But at the end of that 7 years, time for a wedding, and Rachel's father walks his daughter down the aisle. Now, in the story, if you read it, it's a little different than that, okay? But understand, they get to the wedding, and the next morning he wakes up, and it's not Rachel, it's Leah that he has for the wife. Jacob had been tricked. The dad had tricked him. See, the dad spoke very carefully. He could have his daughter, but he didn't say which one. He didn't give him Rachel. It was Leah. Pretty crafty dad. But Jacob didn't want her. So the father told them, okay, marry her, keep her. Now work for me for another 7 years, then you can marry Rachel. No, I think this was the dad's plan all along, okay? Jacob worked another 7 years, 14 years. He has two brides and one, really one that he only loves. A little twisted? Now you got to hang with me. It gets even more twisted. Leah ends up having 6 sons and a girl. And catch this, Jacob then took Leah's servant and had 2 more kids, and 2 with Rachel's servant. Can you say just a little bit more dysfunction in the family going on? Okay. But Rachel struggled to get pregnant. And Rachel was the one that he loved. And a number of years go by, and finally, Rachel is able to conceive a son, and she gives birth to a son, and his name is Joseph. And remember, Jacob was older here. He's quite a bit older than her, and she also then gave birth to a 2nd son, Benjamin. And it was during that birthing process of Benjamin that Rachel ended up dying. So here's Jacob, 12 sons, and only 2 from his beloved Rachel, who is now dead. Here's where I want to pick up the story. In Genesis 37, verse 3, look how it reads. Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other children because Joseph had been born to him in his old age. So one day Jacob had a special gift made for Joseph, a beautiful robe, but his brothers hated Joseph because their father loved him more than the rest of them. They couldn't say a kind word to him. Jacob loved Joseph more than the other children. Now let's see here, family baggage. Oh, that's right. Mom loved Jacob more than Esau. Dad loved Esau more than Jacob. Now Jacob begins to play favorites, giving and doing things for Joseph that he wouldn't do for the other children. Every sibling knows it. Matter of fact, I think we hear the story and go, it doesn't happen today. I go, I'll tell you, sitting down and doing pastoral counseling over the years, it still is happening in people's families. But here we got Joseph coming onto the scene. I remember in Sunday school learning about Joseph and his colored coat. How many of you colored Joseph's coat in Sunday school growing up? Okay? But back then, my teacher never connected the coat with family dysfunction. So the kids today are coloring the coat today, and they're not talking about family dysfunction back in the kids in the children's area. But here is a dad. He doesn't hide the fact that he plays favorites. It's in your face kind of stuff. Imagine Christmas morning with this family. Now, Jacob was a rich man. You got to understand, he had lots of money. So he could have gotten up on Sunday, you know, on a Christmas morning, and guys go outside, the 11 boys go outside, and there's mopeds, 11 mopeds all in a row. Each one of you get one of those. But Joseph, I got something for you. Here's a little box for you. And Joseph opens it up, and there's keys. He gets a new F-150. It's Brian Harling here today. It's a Dodge Ram if it's for him. So, but you understand, here's bad parenting. Made the brothers hate and resent Joseph. It led to verbal abuse and confrontations between them. And then to stoke the fire, the story goes that Joseph ended up having some dreams. And he made the mistake about telling the dream to his brothers. Let me show you what they are. Look at it, 37, verse 5 to 8. One night, Joseph had a dream, and when he told his brothers about it, they hated him more than ever. Listen to this dream, he said. We were out in a field tying up bundles of grain. Suddenly, my bundle stood up, and your bundles all gathered around and bowed low before mine. His brothers responded, "So you think you will be our king, do you? Do you actually think you will reign over us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dreams. So here's a dad playing favorites. He knew the other sons hated Joseph. He knew about the dream. And dad knew that it was making them even hate them more. He was aware of it. And what did he do? Nothing. Did he stop playing favorites? No. What did he do? He twiddled his thumbs. Look how it's recorded in verse 11 here. His father kept the matter in mind. What do we have here? Here's a passive father. He twiddled his thumbs and said, you know, oh, it'll be fine. The boys will work it out. Isn't that common phrase in parenting? But you wonder why all they hate Joseph so much? Can you kind of say, duh, for Jacob? He sticks his head in the sand, clueless about the family dysfunction. Now, I don't have time to keep reading much in the text here this morning, because I want to talk through the story. So understand this. Right after that dream, Joseph's brothers go out into the pasture to spend time taking care of the father's flocks. They've been gone for some time. And Jacob tells Joseph, go out and check the boys. And give me a report back. Well, now, reading even between the lines there, just stop a second, doesn't say it, but Joseph is 17 at this point. He should have been out with the other guys in the fields taking care of the flocks. He got out of work. But he goes out there, and his brothers see him coming, and they say, here's the dreamer coming, and they make plans to kill him. But the brothers then rip off his robe when he goes out there, what he was wearing. They grab him and they throw him in a water tank or a cistern, big hole in the ground, and they sit down and they eat, and then they see this caravan coming out from the distance, and it's a group that's a bunch of traders that are heading to Egypt. So Joseph, or Judah actually, talks to brothers and let's not kill them. Let's sell Joseph as a slave for 20 pieces of silver. Then what they did is they took a goat, they killed it, they put blood all over that coat, and then they sent the beautiful coat back to their father with this message, look what we found. Doesn't this robe belong to, quote, your son? Doesn't say brothers in this, your son. See, when you look at this story, you go, how's that for a dysfunctional family? So a 17-year-old young boy is being shipped off to Egypt, but the story wasn't done for Joseph yet. If you know the rest of the story, it doesn't get any easier. In Egypt, he's bought by an official. Went okay for a little while until the official's wife sees him. It says he's a good-looking young man. She lusted after him. She wanted him sexually. He refused. And he's falsely accused of rape by this official's wife. And he ends up in jail. So here's a young man minding his own business. People have been hating him. Brothers, siblings don't like him, betrayed him, abused him. And it all started in his family. Folks, Joseph was a real victim. And it wasn't his fault. And if anybody could have demanded the right to say that life is unfair, it would be Joseph. If anybody had the right to say, I'm going to be bitter and angry, it would be Joseph. But here's the deal. God was not on the sidelines. He was actively involved still in Joseph's life. See, understand this. When he was put in the jail for that rape charge, he should have been put to death. But in this story, there's a piece here that gives us a clue that actually begins to break the chains between Joseph and his family. See, in spite of the dysfunction, Joseph, understand this, had committed to walk with God. And consequently, God protected him. See, and this leads to a principle that one must pursue if we're going to take the next steps in breaking the chains of dysfunction. If you're following along in the outline today, I said it this way, letting go and moving forward. We need to walk with God, and in the midst of that chaos, the family chaos, we must pursue integrity. I could have written in there, pursue righteousness as well. That would fit there as well. But understand Joseph here is that he pursued integrity by walking with God. And it was because of his integrity that the official in the prison looked at him and says, this was a false charge. It saved him. His character saved him. So you don't find Joseph, it's not written anywhere where he's trying to blame people, anger, bitterness. He keeps walking toward Christ. So a young man in bondage because of his family, he handled himself with such character even while in prison that actually what happened there is he was put in charge of all of the prisoners. He was kind of the lead guy. And then the story continues that because of his integrity, he ended up telling what a dream meant to another prisoner. See, there was another prisoner there in prison that had come from Pharaoh's court. He was a cupbearer that had actually also been falsely imprisoned. And Joseph interprets the dream of this cupbearer, and eventually the cupbearer got exonerated, and he returned back to Pharaoh. And it's just a coincidence, okay, that Pharaoh has a dream, and this cupbearer remembers the man who interpreted his dream. Coincidence, isn't it? But these disturbing dreams that Pharaoh had, he needed somebody, and so what did they look back, and he goes, the statement was made, Joseph walked with his God. So Pharaoh brings him in. It interprets his dream. Let me show you the response of what happened in this setting here. Genesis chapter 41. Look how it reads. In front of Pharaoh here, Joseph's suggestions were well received by Pharaoh and his officials. So Pharaoh asked his officials, can we find anyone else like this man so obviously filled with the Spirit of God? So here's an Egyptian making this statement. Did you catch the integrity of Joseph? And Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God had revealed the meaning of the dreams to you, clearly no one else is intelligent or as wise as you. You will be in charge of my court, and all my people will take orders from you. Only I, sitting on my throne, will have a rank higher than yours. Wherever Joseph went, the command was shouted, kneel down. So Pharaoh put Joseph in charge of all of Egypt. And Pharaoh said to him, I am Pharaoh, but no one will lift a hand or foot in the entire land of Egypt without your approval. Do we catch what happened as Joseph walked with God? Comes out of family dysfunction, But the integrity and his pursuit of righteousness changed something. And it leads to an application here for us this morning, because walking with Christ begins the process of writing, or you could maybe say rewriting, a new legacy for your family. You catch how that's breaking the chains? Something new can begin. Yes, it starts out with forgiveness. But it's also about the journey of a changed heart in that process, moving us to have a heart of integrity, a heart of righteousness. And that can only be built on a relationship with Christ and the Father. And do we realize the journey of being in a dysfunctional family gives opportunity for God to work? Listen closely on this one. Troubles and suffering, even within the dynamics of our families, gives an opportunity for us to experience the radical grace of God. See, we can be disappointed with our families, with our dynamics of the family, but the opportunity to actually experience grace is profound. It's profound. Let me keep going because there's more to the story. Now, if you grew up with a church, you probably know the rest of it. The brothers, because of a famine, have to come to Egypt, and they end up bowing down in front of Joseph. They don't recognize Joseph. Joseph recognizes them. But understand this, as he sees his brothers, the integrity of his heart, the character of who he is, began to spill out and give grace to his brothers, forgiving them, making sure that they were cared for. See, it leads to one last application for this morning. I said it this way: walking with Christ and the spiritual integrity makes room for us to begin to give away, sometimes to our families, radical grace. Instead of hatred, Joseph gives mercy. Instead of vengeance, he gives care. And you go, man, how did he do that with the life that he lived? Folks, we must leave room for that happening. Especially, does God open that door all the time for that to happen? Maybe, maybe not. But we need to leave room for the idea that if God opens that door, that we actually might be giving grace in a way that's profound into our families' lives. Now, the Bible, for Joseph, there's one thing that we can miss here. It actually speaks to it. It's really about Joseph and how he dealt with it. When he became a father, some steps that he had to take to break it, break this bondage. Let me put a verse on the screen for you from Genesis 41. Look how it reads. Joseph named his older son, his first son, Manasseh. And he said, God made me forget all my troubles and everyone in my father's family. Manasseh in Hebrew means forget. See, this story is the essence of beginning to understand how we forget. Now, is it a case of holy amnesia? The answer is no. We're still going to remember it. But forgetting doesn't have to be meaning that we forget it. There's a way of forgetting where we begin to look and it becomes more and more distant. Because Joseph stayed true to God. He trusted God with everything. He trusted God with his painful childhood. And because he kept giving things over to God, walking with integrity, because he honored God in whatever place he was at, the things that he was going through, Joseph was building a new legacy. The past did not matter anymore. He was letting go, a type of forgetting, not remembering it. Think of Romans 8. I won't put it on the screen. The promise is that God works all things together for good. But even farther, some of that good is a new legacy of a new family beginning with a new heritage that can, in a positive way, go from generation to generation. We do it different, not out of anger, but out of integrity. We let go of the past. Now, it's interesting, working with families for years and years, sometimes people look at healthier families and they think it just happens. Some people have said this to me a couple of times. You don't have children like mine. Do you know what they're implying? Your kids are easy, mine are not. Now, what I've wanted to say, I've never said it to them, but what I'd want to say is I would say this: you have no clue the work that we put in terms of trying to break the chains in our family dynamics. Deanna and I have tried to be very intentional in looking what it means to break the chains. Have it been perfect? The answer is no. There are some things that we could say about our chains and our history that are very hard. My wife has gone through some hard stuff. But see, the question comes back, are people willing to trust God and put in the time to forge a new path and a new legacy? It doesn't happen by just sitting there and doing nothing. See, and even Father's Day today, dads, are you willing to put in the time to rebuild a new legacy? It starts with character, integrity, but doing things different. I got a blog came through, an article on Monday morning, and it was from Church and Culture. And I want to read that. I want to put that on the screen for you to read along with me. And this is from Church and Culture site. Here's what he wrote. I've been saying it, teaching it for decades. Men, you have a unique role in the life of your daughter, and specifically her future relationships with men. And now the research is out to back it up. Thanks to a study published in the Journal of Developmental Psychology, it has now been established that if a dad is detached or uninvolved, when his daughter will be more promiscuous. Yes, fathers matter that much to the development of their daughters. If they communicated well with their fathers and felt close to them, they experienced much more parental monitoring and hung out far less with sexually risk-prone peers. Going further, the prolonged presence of a warm and engaged father can buffer girls against early high-risk sex. The bottom line, it's all about the dosage of exposure to dads. The bigger the dose, the more fathering matters. Take that into Father's Day, literally. Men, you are making a difference in your father's life. You are the ones establishing what conduct, what behavior she will accept or reject. I took my daughters out on dates and treated them like princesses they were. I demonstrated how the father and man in their life felt about them, honored them, cherished them, and I set a standard for how they should expect men to treat them. I lavished physical affection and emotional attention on my daughters. I did not want them to have a man-shaped hole as a result of a distant father whose love they craved. I still can't go too long without draping them in a hug. I taught my boys to honor women, starting with the women in our family. My wife and my two daughters were protected by the three men in their life they deferred to. The three of us opened doors to them, gave up seats in crowded areas, pulled back chairs for them at a restaurant. I was not only teaching my boys how to be real men, but creating a nurturing environment for my wife and the daughters to reinforce their sense of self-esteem. I worked hard to keep open lines of communication, particularly as they got older. I would bring them with me on trips. We would sit at Starbucks. I would sit on their beds at night. I would constantly ask questions. My daughters had a father who was far less than perfect. I had more than his fair share of sin and made many mistakes, but I loved them, and they knew it. And I was there for them, and they could count on it. And I would talk with them, and they could talk with me. They were fathered, and that can make all the difference in the world. dated June 12th. I know this author, I read his blog quite often. And the fact is, if you go back to his childhood, he was intentionally breaking chains with his family, with the past. He was intentional in starting a new legacy. See, my hunch is that Jacob, it doesn't say it in the scriptures, but I believe that Jacob did it different with his sons, or Joseph did it with his sons. See, as he walked with God, he developed that heart and the righteousness, and it made a difference in his children. And by the way, if you're a mom here today, this applies to you as well. You leave a legacy as well. But you got to hear this. It never is too late to start, no matter what age we are as men. You might be a parent here today where you go, oh, I wish that I wouldn't have. And I go, there's something you can do. You may need to go back to that grown son or daughter and ask for forgiveness and to start a conversation and admit some of the things that you struggled with. It's knocking on their door and opening up your relationship with them. See, are we willing to help even our kids break those chains? Even if we're older, can we have those conversations that might just spur on them as they interact with their children? Elders, for communion, I'm going to invite you up here. We're just about done. See, where do we do the work? Where do we understand the chaos that we may have grown up in? Are we willing to do the work as moms and dads? And maybe the illustration is this. When we're willing to do the work, when we look in the rearview mirror there, it becomes more and more distant. Now, is it ever totally gone? The answer is no, but it's a speck back there. But if we're not willing to do the work, I think we look in the mirror, and guess what? That car is right on our tail. Headlights are on, and we see it. Are we willing to bow before Christ and begin the process of really letting go, helping break those chains? We come to communion today. We recognize that even that Jesus died for us to break the patterns of sin in our lives. He wants to set us free. Guys, if you want to even hand out the bread, he went to the cross. So the sins that we committed, the sins that I committed as a father, he wanted to nail those sins to the cross. But it's more than forgiveness. It's setting us free to love well, to build a new legacy, to make a difference in our children's lives, to start new patterns. God wants to give us freedom. Hold the elements. We're asking you just to hold those for right now. We want to take those in unison, just so it shows our unity in Christ. But just remember today what Jesus has done for us to give us freedom.